Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. In the long history of war, a general's doctrine was terribly simple. Kill the enemy and terrorize anyone who supports the enemy. Well, there's a new normal for American commanders in Afghanistan.
First thing I would say is when President Karzai approved the conduct of this operation, he gave us some very specific guidance. And that guidance was to continue to protect the people of Afghanistan. And so this operation has been done with that in mind.
General Stanley McChrystal speaking after 12 Afghan civilians were killed in a NATO strike in Marja. Thousands of Afghans have died in this war, so many that the country's civilians may be near a political tipping point, struggling in a fight to the death while pledging to protect life. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 17th. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in this week for John Hockenberry. I'm here with Celeste Headlee. And Celeste, the takeaway for me on Afghanistan is there's a new normal for U.S. troops and U.S. commanders having to fight this war where even 12 civilian deaths, even though one is too many, 12 is a political problem for our troops.
It is a political problem, but I think there's also kind of some encouraging signs coming out of Afghanistan that our military is learning, which is a good thing. Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning. Toyota's problems keep piling up. The automaker is now considering a recall of the world's best-selling car, the Corolla, because of possible power steering problems. Speaking just hours ago, Toyota President Akio Toyoda said he will not attend a congressional hearing on his company's safety lapses. Toyota's U.S. executives will be sent instead. Toyota did promise a brake override system in all future models worldwide as a safety measure against the acceleration problems behind the recent global recalls. We're going to have more details on that in a half an hour.
Meanwhile, in Afghanistan...
He needs tracers! Tracers!
U.S. Marines and Afghan forces continue to battle the Taliban on the streets of Marja. NATO says four service members have been killed in the assault so far. For the first time in this fight, U.S. troops are firing non-lethal smoke rounds in an effort to disperse fighters. That's an effort to save civilian lives. This comes as Afghan officials say Taliban fighters are using women and children as human shields during the fighting. That's according to Afghan officials. For more on this, we're joined now by Rod Nordland, correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. He's in Kabul. Rod, good morning.
Good morning.
Rod, this whole strategy in the Marja offensive is to avoid civilian casualties so that the death of these dozen civilians that we've been reading about and hearing about came as a real blow to U.S. and NATO allies. What are the politics on the ground now in the aftermath of these civilian deaths?
Well, there are a number of things that are really striking about this incident. And first of all, it's the speed with which the military, right up to General McChrystal, the commander, immediately took responsibility for it, immediately launched an investigation, and even took the weapon system that apparently caused the deaths, took it out of service until they could investigate whether some fault in the machinery was to blame. And that's just not the kind of thing we've seen before. And one of the tragedies of this, minor ironic tragedies of this particular incident, is that that weapon system, the HIMARS rocket, it's a rocket launcher that can be fired from quite a distance away, but with very high accuracy. That was employed because we're using airstrikes much less in order to keep civilian casualties down.
So U.S. commanders trying to react quickly to civilian deaths and to manage the bull black right away. Rod, stay with us. We're going to be back with you in just a moment.
Meanwhile, in Iraq, the number of American troops has dropped below 100,000 for the first time since the war began. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,268, the S&P at 1,094, and the NASDAQ opens at 22.14. We're going to talk about food that you might want to eat for Chinese New Year, but it's the start of another year, year two of the stimulus. The bill was signed a year ago, and we're wondering, what do you think? Give us a report on your area. Are you seeing signs of the stimulus or not? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to thetakeaway.org. We're going to have more on Afghanistan and the goal of zero civilian casualties in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this week, here with Celeste Headlee, of course. NATO allies have entered their fifth day of a major offensive in the Taliban-controlled city of Marja in southern Afghanistan. Reports from the field indicate that Operation Mushtarak is going according to plan for the most part. That's apart from the deaths a couple of days ago of 12 civilians as the U.S.-led NATO offensive got underway. There's a political cost now for almost every civilian death in Afghanistan, as thousands of Afghan civilian deaths have mounted over this 8.5-year war. Rod Norland of the New York Times, our partner, is in Kabul. We're going to be talking with him, and later we're going to be talking with retired Army Colonel Jack Jacobs to give us a sense of what U.S. troops and their commanders are facing in a difficult situation on the ground. But Rod, good morning.
Good morning.
Rod, as I mentioned, every civilian death now in the political calculus of the Afghan war, every civilian death comes with a political price to U.S. forces. What is the latest fallout now from the death of 12 civilians at the opening of this offensive?
Well, you know, it's striking. If you compare this incident to some much more horrific cases of civilian casualties in past years in Afghanistan, cases where as many as 100 people or more were killed at attending a funeral or a wedding. This happened several times, and every time the military spun it as best they could. They claimed there were insurgents. They denied it happened. They just did everything they could to obfuscate it. And in this case, you know, they took responsibility very quickly. And you know, the Afghan government President Karzai has criticized the Americans over civilian casualties. But in this case, we had the Afghan government spinning it and trying to claim that three of the 12 people who were killed were Taliban insurgents,
And you also reported a bit of a spin, if you will, that Afghan officials were saying, well, even if 9 or 12 of our civilians were killed, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands will be freed. I mean, that's a spin if I ever heard one.
Yeah, that's right. And although, I mean, no, the survivors, when a bunch of soldiers come up and officials and everything after 12 people have been killed, are not in any position to give you their true feelings. And they're going to say what they want you to hear. They've just had a demonstration of what can happen to them. So I don't put much credence in that. But, you know, our reporter, Chris Chivers, was, as it happened, with the unit that was fighting in that immediate area. And they called in an artillery strike, a rocket strike, but not on that building. And he was there and you know, overheard their shock and dismay when they saw that the wrong building had been hit.
And those troops were using a rocket system that was supposed to be the alternative to unmanned drone attacks, which, while comparatively surgical when there's no human eyes on the ground, can lead to civilian casualties. The point was to avoid such an incident.
Right. Although this weapon system was probably 20 miles away, they had the power to call it in. They say they did not in this case, and it may have been somebody else on the battlefield, even someone looking through a drone. We don't know yet what happened, although they have ruled out any kind of mechanical fault in the HIMARS system. But the other striking thing that Chris Chivers saw and we reported on in our story today is the way, right down to the platoon level, the soldiers really have taken on board this message that, you know, civilian casualties are a dumb idea in this kind of war. And you know, their commander, the battalion commander, one of the first things he did when he came in to this area that's still fairly hot was go and visit the household and the elders, and even arranged transport for those victims to a cemetery.
Rod Nordland of our partner, the New York Times, thanks. It's interesting the dynamic you talk about of how U.S. troops seem to have learned the lesson and learned it hard, that even one civilian casualty in Afghanistan is too many. And there are signs that Afghan civilians are cooperating in many places in Marja with U.S. troops, helping to point out enemy positions, helping to point out the position of improvised explosive devices. I want to bring in retired Army Colonel Jack Jacobs to give us a sense of what U.S. troops may be facing on the ground there as they interact with civilians and try to disarm IEDs and try to avoid civilian casualties. Colonel, good morning.
Good morning.
As U.S. troops advance, trying to disarm what are reported to be thousands of IEDs, What difference does it make to them to, at least according to many reports from our troops, having Afghan civilians pointing out any enemy positions or enemy weaponry when you're on the ground in the fight? What difference does this make?
Well, it makes all the difference in the world. Going blind into an area which you don't know about is very, very dangerous, particularly if it's filled with civilians whose casualties you're trying to minimize or eliminate, on the one hand. And on the other hand, getting cooperation from people on the ground who point out to you where the IEDs and booby traps are located. You know, we gave plenty of warning to the enemy on the ground that we were coming, and for good reason, too. We wanted them to get out of there if they possibly could and avoid a fight. Because in the end, what we want is them out of there. We don't necessarily want to have to fight them. And as a result of that, the enemy set up lots of booby traps and improvised explosive devices. And getting through the area successfully and securing it requires that the local population assist, and apparently that's what they're doing.
And do you think that U.S. commanders would have had a good sense before embarking on this strategy of announcing the offensive ahead of time, knowing there would be booby traps there? Did U.S. commanders probably have a good sense that they would get good cooperation from civilians? I ask it because if they were entering a hostile environment, this might have been a much different story.
Well, the attitude is that the area itself is not necessarily hostile. That is, the entire population isn't hostile, but that there's a certain element in there that needs to be eliminated from there. And when you start with that assumption, your modus operandi is very much different than the kinds of things we had done before. As you start off with the notion that the people there, by and large, want to be free of domination, want to take care of themselves, which they had done for centuries and centuries, don't want any outside interference. And the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, no different. They don't want those guys there either. When you start with that assumption, you treat the local population and the military operation very much different. You can see the result of that kind of attitude, which has been fostered by people like General Petraeus and General McChrystal and General Caldwell, all of whom have a great deal of experience having studied unconventional war and studied the difference between it and going around blowing everything up and yet, trying to sort it out afterwards.
And yet that strategy is all the more difficult with any civilian deaths. Retired Colonel Jack Jacobs, thanks for joining us to talk about conditions on the ground in Afghanistan. We also heard from Rod Nordland reporting from Kabul on civilian deaths among the Afghan populations in the Marja offensive. Let's check in now on some of the top stories we're following at quarter past the hour.
A year ago today, President Obama's stimulus package was rolled out. The White House is releasing a report now on the results. Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says the stimulus has been a success, but he admits many Americans are not yet seeing the benefits.
You've just lost your job. Your wife just lost their job. You're having trouble figuring out how you're going to pay for your kids' college. And somebody says, how's the Recovery Act working?
This morning, Toyota's president said he will not make a trip to America to testify before Congress about vehicle safety issues. He says Toyota's U.S. executives will answer lawmakers' questions. Meanwhile, the Department of Transportation has asked Toyota to hand over documents related to their worldwide recalls.
Turning now to Haiti, French leader Nicolas Sarkozy will visit the country later. Meanwhile, costs from January's devastating earthquake are adding up. Andrew Powell from the Inter-American Development Bank says damage estimates are more than the entire size of Haiti's economy.
For the death toll and the intensity that we're talking about, something of the order of $8 billion.
Finally, the U.S. has appointed an ambassador to Syria for the first time in 5 years. That's as United States official William Burns visits Damascus today.
That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, you voted. You voted in the hundreds. We're going to announce the winner today, best in show in our takeaway dog show. And it's not my beagle, sadly.
Well, I might have voted for your... I voted for your beagle in my heart, even though you're not really eligible to win.
I voted for my beagle in my heart.
He's, Colette, she's a little heavy around the middle, I thought.
She's not. She's very thin.
Oh, she is? Okay.
Yeah.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. Or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout today comes from the world of international finance, specifically from Greece. Here's Finance Minister George Papakonstantinou. He was yesterday attempting to reassure the European Union that Greece has got its financial crisis under control.
The Greek government has already started the implementation of its stability and growth program, which exactly deals with the problem of the excessive deficit.
Louise Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter for a part in the New York Times. A little fact-checking here. A, is he right? Do they have it under control? And B, who is he trying to convince?
So they've got a month, Celeste. The EU, the European body, has given Greece a deadline. They've got 1 month to prove that they can lower their deficit this year to an adequate level. And it's unclear if they can do that because it's a big drop. Right now, their deficit as a percentage of their GDP is 12.7%. And they've got to prove within a month that they can get it to 8.7% this year. Now, keep in mind, the real level in Europe you're supposed to have is 3%.
Three, right.
So they are just way over.
Four times the amount. But what happens if they don't?
The EU did not lay out a consequence, but remember, Greece is reliant on the EU for all kinds of things, and, you know, it may not get the help it needs if it doesn't deliver. So, you know, anger is rising. I don't know if you heard also, we do not know the motive, but there was a bombing yesterday
at J.P. Morgan's
in Athens.
Offices.
In Athens, at right. J.P. Morgan's office in Athens. The other issue here is that the EU is very sternly looking at some deals that Greece did with banks like Goldman Sachs. We talked about this on the show on Monday,
right.
Where these derivatives helped Greece hide some of its debt level. And these deals enabled the debt to build a bit in Greece without people knowing this. So the EU has told Greece they need to tell all the details of these deals right away, reveal how they worked. Greece is saying they were legal at the time, but it's unclear until we get more information about them whether they were. And there were some stern words from the banks for the banks. Europe's economic minister said the banks themselves should ask, not the least after the financial crisis, if this has been in line with the code of ethics. So even if it was legal, was it ethical?
Was it right? Right. Here we were thinking that the heat was off America, and then Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan turned out to be somewhere involved in this story. Louise Story, Wall Street finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
Time for a sports takeout now with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, it's all about money in Greece and the EU and at Goldman Sachs. What do you know? It's all about money at the NBA as well. The NBA's trading deadline is 3 p.m. tomorrow. Now, LeBron James plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers, and even though we're talking about trades, LeBron's probably staying in Cleveland, but this is affecting trades all around the league, and I know this is about money. It has to be.
At the core of this is about LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, who plays for the Miami Heat, and Chris Bosh, who plays for the Toronto Raptors. These are three major superstars who on their teams have they're coming up for free agency in the summertime. Chris Bosh is being rumored to being traded this year, but the big name right now is Amari Stoudemire, who plays for the Phoenix Suns, and the Heat are coveting him as well as the Cleveland Cavaliers. He can help out both teams as they make a final push towards the playoffs.
Okay, but unlike Greece or the United States for that matter, the Cleveland Cavaliers or the Miami Heat can't deficit spend on their salaries, right? So they got to worry about what all these guys make.
Precisely. So they have to move around guys and make tough decisions. The Cavs are in a good situation. They can pull in either him or Antoine Jameson from the Wizards. Well, the flip side is that you have a team like the Knicks who are trying to unload and dump contracts because they're trying to attract a big-name free agent in the summertime. So they want to get a LeBron James or a Dwayne Wade. So what they're looking at doing is bundling some of their younger players and sending them to Houston to get Tracy McGrady because his contract expires. He's an aging superstar, but what you get is basically $35 million of space in their ability to attract someone like Dwayne Wade or LeBron or a couple of guys together.
But, you know, LeBron will probably stay in Cleveland, and if they keep LeBron James and then get Amari Stoudemire, holy cow.
So that's
who could beat the Cavaliers?
And that's where it is. The Cavs will be extremely dangerous with LeBron, Shaquille O'Neal, and Amari Stoudemire.
All right, all these teams are bundling their players,
their assets,
their assets, and bundling their players' salaries into packages and shipping them off. Louise Story is nodding across the table. She's saying, this sounds familiar. This sounds a lot like Fannie Mae to me. Maybe I should watch more NBA. All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And for our last takeout, it's time to go to the dogs. We have more than 100 photo submissions of your favorite dogs. The Kennel Club at thetakeaway.org, but we do have a winner based on your votes. Drum roll there, Todd. Thank you. The best in show, Benny, a 5-year-old Chihuahua from California who looks terrified in his photo. You might remember it. He's sandwiched in between two very tough-looking Siamese cats. And according to Barbara Fullerton, she bought Benny for her daughter. It's his ears that really win people over.
I love animals with big ears, and I think the ears are just so endearing in this picture. I just love their ears.
And our takeaway listeners loved Benny. His fellow pet mates didn't think quite as highly of him. Here's Benny's owner, Bethany Fullerton.
He's not crazy about those cats. They kind of bully him because they were in the house for a while before Benny came along. The cats were kind of like two old men, just already set in their ways. So when he came along, they were not happy.
Now, Benny is an award-winning dog, of course, and so we ask Barbara what advice she'd give to the winner of the Westminster Dog Show, who is a Michigan dog, Sadie, a terrier.
Sadie, yeah.
My advice for the winner of the Westminster Dog Show is to look frightened. That seems to be Benny's charm.
Thanks to everybody for taking part. If you haven't seen these photos, you've got to go to the website. So they're sickeningly sweet and adorable. Our producer gets his wish, and Ibrahim as well, who's a cat person, will have a cat show soon. You can see all the pictures of the dogs on our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up...
私としましては、この時点ではグローバルな品質安全のため...
That's Toyota's president speaking a few hours ago about his company's problems. He is not coming to the U.S. to speak to the Congress, though. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. Todd, did you have a favorite out of the dog show, by the way?
Host choice. I'm going with Job the Husky, hands
down.
Is
it Job?
I think it's Job. I think it was Job. He was the cover photo, and I saw that photo. I didn't need to click through right away. And best smile, I'm going with Roger the Chesapeake
Retriever.
I
really liked Frankie the overweight bulldog, or Lucy the Jack Russell, who had her tongue kind of hanging out. Look totally blissfully happy. I mean, you can't get much happier than a Jack Russell who's playing.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. It's 30 minutes past the hour, and it's time to take a look at the headlines. You know, Todd, every week we do our Good Week, Bad Week segment on Friday, and it looks like Toyota may be on the list for Bad Week.
I think you're right.
Yet again. This morning we're learning the automaker is considering a recall of the Corolla because of possible power steering problems. The Corolla is the world's best-selling car. Speaking just hours ago, Toyota's president said all future models will have a brake override system. We'll have more on this story in just a few moments. Today also marks the one-year anniversary of President Obama's $787 billion stimulus package. This morning, CBS News asked Vice President Joe Biden if Americans have gotten a bang for their buck.
Absolutely, but I don't think they realize it. Number one. Number two, it was designed to have two stages to it. We've only been halfway through the act. The job-creating portions are really loaded at the second half here.
Biden says so far less than $200 billion has been doled out, but the pace of spending is expected to increase soon.
There are reports this morning that Walgreens is getting ready to buy rival drugstore chain Duane Reade in a deal valued at more than $1 billion. So, meanwhile here, who is top dog?
Best in show at the 134th Westminster Kennel Club is going to be the Scottish Terrier.
Sadie the Scotty!
Sadie the Scotty is the 8th Scottish Terrier to win Best in Show at the Westminster Dog Show here in New York City. So those judges may have picked a terrier for their dog show, but the Takeaway listeners have picked a Chihuahua in our own Best in Show competition. Check out all the entrants at thetakeaway.org and see why Benny got the most votes. Let's check in on the markets. Asian markets and European markets are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,268. The S&P opens at 1,094, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,214. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
You know, every week we do our Good Week, Bad Week segment, Todd.
Yeah.
This week, as it was last week, it appears to be Toyota might be in the running Bad Week
they're
again.
They're racking them up.
They've recalled already more than 8.1 million vehicles. They're facing dozens of class action lawsuits. They've announced that they're temporarily stopping production at two U.S. plants. And now it looks like they may be having to recall the Corolla as well for power steering problems. Through it all, the company's been perhaps too heavily criticized for poorly handling the media and controlling their PR campaign. In response, Toyota's president held a press conference early this morning. The BBC's Roland Burke was there.
Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, told reporters that the company had not tried to hide safety problems. He was speaking at his third news conference in 2 weeks, seeking to reassure customers after more than 8 million vehicles were recalled. But in a sign Toyota's crisis could widen still further, the executive in charge of quality controls, Shinichi Sasaki, said it was looking into a possible problem with the power steering on the Corolla. He did not announce a recall and said they'd received fewer than 100 complaints.
That's the BBC's Roland Burke. A congressional committee hearing is due to take place in Washington next week to discuss this PR debacle and its impact on consumers. We're joined now by David Champion. He's the director of automobile testing for Consumer Reports. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
We were just talking about the fact that A, Toyota has been criticized for hiding some of its problems, and B, the Toyota's president is not coming to the United States to testify before the congressional committee. Do you feel like they're not handling this well with the media and with their own consumers?
I think it's a lot of bad news coming out all at one time, and I don't think Toyota has been used to so many bad news stories coming out at one time. So I don't think they're particularly used to it, and I don't think they've handled it particularly well.
Well, you know, you and your magazine have actually rescinded your recommendations for 8 Toyota models. I assume that's because of the recalls. How did that decision come about?
Well, it was a bit strange to have a vehicle recommended by Consumer Reports that you couldn't actually buy. So we pulled the recommendations due to the stop sale on those vehicles.
But not because you don't recommend them anymore.
They're not recommended because they're not on sale. Once the problems have been fixed with the recall, we will be putting the recommended designation back on them.
Do you feel any sense of, I don't want to say betrayal, maybe too harsh of a word, but do you feel any sense of disappointment that Toyota may have known about these problems at the same time that you are testing these products and recommending them?
Every manufacturer has recalls on their cars that are continually going. I think there was somewhere in the region of 500 and something recalls last year on cars that are out there. So it's not it's not strange to have a vehicle that's been recalled that we've rated very highly. We actually think recalls are a very good thing. If a problem has been found, they contact the owner and fix the problem as soon as they can.
But, you know, the issue here is that Toyota knew about these problems and did not deal with them and were not forced to deal with them until there were actually deaths involved in some of these issues. So, I mean, have we been a little bit soft on Toyota because we're so used to them being reliable, safe vehicles?
I do believe that the original recall, I have to take exemption that they didn't do anything. The original recall on a number of these vehicles was to remove the floor mats. And that was in 2007. And a lot of that recall was left up to the consumer to actually remove the floor mats. I don't think that recall and the solution to the recall was satisfactory. I don't believe any safety defect should be left up to the consumer to implement and to keep the floor mats out of the vehicle. I can imagine my own household, if I took the floor mats out of my wife's car and she saw them hanging in the garage and the winter came, she'd put them straight back in again. So I think that was a very poorly executed recall.
Still, at the same time, David Champion, this is Todd Zwillick here. A lot of consumers who are consumers of Toyotas, but also consumers of your magazine, might be wondering how you tested these cars without catching problems with accelerators and floor mats or braking systems. Help us understand what it means to test these cars and why maybe Consumer Reports didn't catch these things.
Yes, we're also looking into our methodology, but we have to put it into some sort of context here. There is something in the region of 2,000 to 3,000 complaints of unintended acceleration due to the carpets issue in Toyota vehicles over a 10-year period, which in that same period, Toyota produced in the region of 20 million vehicles. So it's a 1 in 10,000 chance that this would happen. When we are actually testing a car, we go out and buy the car anonymously from local dealers, so we don't get one specially prepared by Toyota or any other manufacturer. We buy exactly the same as any consumer would. We make sure it's up to manufacturer standards and then put it through a whole battery of 50 different tests. And we did not find in the testing that we did any issues with the carpets moving forward. Presumably, we had them clipped in.
David Champion of Consumer Reports, Akio Toyota, in his press conference this morning, said he admits that Toyota may have gotten too big too fast and quality may have suffered. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think Toyota has expanded into many, many different regions, and they had a lot of attention to detail on their cars, which really drove the quality of their cars up. As they grew bigger and bigger, I don't think that same attention to detail was implanted on their cars.
Okay, David Champion, Director of Automobile Testing for Consumer Reports. Consumer Reports has withdrawn its recommendations for 8 Toyota models. That's because those models are not currently for sale. Coming up, Happy Chinese New Year. We're going to talk about food as we do every single Wednesday. And in honor of the holiday, we're going to talk about how to celebrate the Chinese New Year with your stomach. There's lucky foods out there. We're going to tell you what they are. That's coming up later this hour. It's also the start of another year for the stimulus bill. The stimulus bill was signed a year ago today. But is it working for you? We want to hear your view from the ground. Be a reporter for us.
This is Kimberly in Atlanta. Did not realize the positive results of the Stimulus Act until my husband and I went to go get our taxes done. And it turns out that we increased our income by $15,000 based on the tax cuts. And that was not relative to any wage increases at all. So I believe that the stimulus package is working very well.
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or on our website, thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlett. You know, if you read this plot in a Tom Clancy novel, you would think it was far-fetched. 11 professional assassins wearing fake beards and wigs killed a senior Hamas official in his Dubai hotel in January. It's a very complicated story, and to make sense of it, we have Robert Wirth with us. He's the Beirut bureau chief for our partner, the New York Times, and is reporting on the story. Robert, maybe you can just walk us through exactly what we know about this.
Sure. What we know is that a senior Hamas official named Mahmoud Babhou was killed in a Dubai hotel on evening of January 19th. The information didn't come out in the public until the following week because Hamas first made it public. And then Dubai, just on Monday, the Dubai police did an amazing press conference in which they put out all kinds of information, including photographs and passport numbers for 11 accused assassins who were traveling on European passports. Now, it's gotten a little more complicated and interesting since then because Britain and Ireland have said that the passports issued, apparently 6 of these guys are supposed to be British and 3 Irish. There was also a woman, actually, one of the Irish ones, that the passports are fake, and several of the passports appear to have been stolen from British citizens living in Israel. And Israel has not commented on this, but there's a widespread assumption, of course, that the Israeli intelligence agency carried this out, and Hamas has directly accused Israel.
Well, it's no surprise that somebody would accuse Israel of this, but the surprising thing to me is both Israel and Palestine have been accused of being behind this assassination.
That's right. That's right. Two people were arrested. Two Palestinians were arrested. Apparently, one was just arrested because of a phone call. The other one, Dubai officials say, suspected of some kind of role in this plot. It's not clear what. Both Hamas and Fatah, in the West Bank, have been accusing each other of being involved with this guy. It's not clear who he is, but he is Palestinian. And Dubai officials haven't said exactly what his role might have been in the plot.
Well, the victim has been described as a senior Hamas official. Can you tell us something about him that would explain why would somebody might want to kill him?
Sure. He apparently played a role in the kidnapping and killing of 2 Israeli soldiers in 1989. Hamas has also confirmed that he was involved in the procuring of weapons for Hamas from Iran. So he's obviously an important figure.
Well, certainly nobody thinks of Israel in these kind of things as being quite as clumsy as this attempt seemed to have been. We have been watching all along these surveillance videos of these assassins walking in and out of bathrooms, putting on fake beards, going up on the elevator. That's not really Israel style, is it?
Yeah, it does seem kind of clumsy. Maybe it's just that it's harder now with all these cameras everywhere, especially in a place like Dubai, to carry out these kinds of assassinations that were done much more easily back in the 1970s and 80s. And then the other sort of interesting mysterious part of it is that often these things we assume are done by, sort of in private channels, but Dubai, perhaps because it was angry at the way this was done, has made this very public.
Well, they certainly don't want to be known as a place where people come to when they're not safe. They're a tourist center, and I think they need to be known as a safe place to be. Robert Wirth is the Beirut bureau chief for our partner, the New York Times. He's talking about an assassination in a Dubai hotel that took place in January.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry this week, here, of course, with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we talk about food every Wednesday, and with the start of the Chinese New Year, this Year of the Tiger, we talk about foods to celebrate for your Chinese New Year. More in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. A Maldives government spokesman says the Taliban and the Afghan government held face-to-face talks there at the end of January. They reportedly focused on finding a peaceful solution to the Afghan conflict. Toyota has announced steps to restore customer confidence. In a press conference today, company president Akio Toyoda says all future models will have a brake override system to stop sudden acceleration. He also says he will not attend congressional hearings on the company's safety problems. Akio Toyoda says he will leave that to the company's United States executives. At home, President Obama's stimulus plan is 1 year old today. The White House will release a report on the status of the $787 billion package later.
Overseas, the murder of a Hamas leader in Dubai is getting murkier. The now seven Israelis accused in the crime say their identities were stolen. They deny any connection with the death. Hamas blames the murder on Israel's Secret Service. The Secret Service has declined to comment. Back at home at the Westminster Dog Show last night, Judge Elliot Weiss announced the champion.
Best in show at the 134th Westminster Kennel Club is going to be the Scottish Terrier.
Sadie the Scotty!
The breed is from Scotland. The dog is from Mackinac Island in Michigan. Sadie is the eighth Scotty to win at the show since it began in 1877. So those judges may have picked a terrier for their best in show, but Takeaway listeners picked a Chihuahua for our own dog show. You can check out all the entrants at the Takeaway Dog Show, and I encourage you to do so. They are very cute. Benny got the most votes. Finally, breast cancer survivors take aspirin regularly may be 50% less likely to have the disease return. That's according to a new study. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Chinese New Year arrived on Sunday, and with it, a two-week period of celebration kicked off for this year. This is the Year of the Tiger. In honor of the Lunar New Year, and in keeping with our regular Wednesday theme of talking about food, food, and more food, we're chatting with two prominent Chinese Americans about their favorite New Year's food and memories. Diana Kwan has written about food for Gourmet, for Food and Wine in the Boston Globe, and many other publications. She's also founder of the popular blog Appetite for China, which is exactly what we have this morning. We're also joined by B.D. Wong, the Tony Award-winning actor. He's best known for his roles as Dr. George Huang on Law & Order, SVU, Special Victims Unit. You also know him as Father Ray Makuta on HBO's Oz, the sometimes upstanding and sometimes corrupt Father Ray Makuta. Thank you both for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, BD. I want to start with you and a little bit about your upbringing. You were raised in San Francisco, which has a very rich and deep Chinese community. What kind of food do you remember eating with mom and dad and your relatives at this time of year?
I think the first thing that I remember that we still make sure that we have every year is a raw fish salad. And this was a dish that is made up of like a very thinly sliced, like a fluke, and it has all of these amazing, crunchy, different flavored things in it and spices. Chinese five spices, fried wonton skins, fried rice vermicelli, peanuts, lemon juice. It is a kind of a sweet and kind of salty, I believe it is specifically a Cantonese dish, that part of the fun of it was that it was mixed by everybody that was going to eat it.
Sounds delicious. Does it have a name?
Well, in Chinese, it's called yusang or fish salad, I think.
Fish salad.
Really it has lettuce in it, and lettuce is, of course, very important in Chinese food because the Cantonese words for lettuce sound... it's a homonym for something like money or something like that.
Well, Diana Kwan, I personally have never heard of raw fish salad in a Chinese setting. I've certainly eaten enough raw fish in Japanese homes, in Japanese restaurants. Have you tried the raw fish salad yourself?
Is
that a new one to you?
Yeah, that is a new one to me.
Well, you've got a list of 100 Chinese foods that you say every person should eat once before they die. We might get through, I don't know, I might get through maybe 17 or 18 by the time the two-week Lunar New Year is over. So let's go down your list a little bit. Macaroni and Spam, can you help me with this one?
Yes. So macaroni and Spam, they were popular canned goods going into Hong Kong during the British colonial period in the 50s and 60s. So they had a lot of these canned goods on their hands. And that was before they had a real agricultural industry. So they just adapted it to suit the local palate. And they made a soup out of it, a macaroni and Spam, like in a light chicken broth. And they have it for breakfast. And it's quite good.
And right. You just said it. This is good, right? I just want to make sure you're
mm-hmm.
advocating
yes,
for this. Okay.
Good.
All right. I'm going down your list. The thousand year egg. You have to tell me what this is.
So it's not actually a thousand years. It's kind of an exaggeration. What they do is they put it in an earthen jar with like clay and ash and lime and salt, and they preserve it for about 100 days. And when it comes out, it's fermented and it's really pungent and salty, kind of like sardines, but you put it in congee or rice porridge and it's pretty good.
And then BD, listen to this last one that I'm going to give Diana Kwan because I want you to react to it too. Stinky tofu. Tell me that this is good.
I made stinky tofu for my Chinese New Year dinner on Sunday.
Okay, Diana, give us the rundown on stinky tofu. It's obviously one of BD's favorites.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
go ahead, Diana.
It's not stinky.
Think of
though.
Like the strongest blue cheese you've ever had, and that's equivalent to it. You can smell it two blocks away, and it's fermented and salt, and you can cook it with fish and meats and. It flavors the dish.
BD Wong, you've got a challenge here. You say it's not that stinky, but smell it two blocks away and it's fermented. Sounds pretty stinky.
It's fermented in that kind of like alcohol kind of way. It's not cheesy, really. I think it's very
pungent.
Much like wine. Yeah.
Pungent.
Yeah.
It's
pungent.
Strong smelling, but but it's, I mean, I trust me, I made it for a bunch of people who'd never had it before. It was very popular, and it's it's really comfort food for me when I was a kid. It's not necessarily Chinese New Year food, but it's Cantonese soul food for sure.
All right, BD, you've got a couple of favorites here. You say oranges have to be eaten at Chinese New Year. Why is that?
I'm not exactly sure about the why. It's definitely oranges and tangerines, and the tangerines often are served or put out in the home with the green stems and leaves attached to them as a kind of a it's like a spring symbolism, like new growth and rebirth. And,
sure, anything and, round, like we have Easter eggs around and bagels around. It kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, a lot of these things are really like the raw fish salad. You know, China's such a humongous country, and the regional differentiations are really, apparent as you go. As I meet new Chinese people in my grown-up life, I realize that a lot of us have very, very different things.
We're gonna have fun trying all of these dishes, probably until up to and after Chinese New Year has passed. BD Wong, Tony Award-winning actor from Special Victims Unit and also from the prison drama Oz, and Diana Kwan, blogger and writer for Food and Wine in the Boston Globe. Thank you both for taking us through the New Year. Celeste, would you be trying any stinky tofu?
Actually, I like also very pungent cheese, so
that's
fine with me. I actually have two of Diana Kwan's recipes for the Chinese New Year. Stir-fried vermicelli with garlic and scallions. That sounds delicious.
It does.
And also turnip cakes. Those are both on our website at thetakeaway.org. While you're at thetakeaway.org, linger for a moment because we have a whole bunch of extras there. We need your help on tallying up who's having a good week and who's having a bad week. Every Friday we look back. We need your suggestions. We're going to compare them to the picks that come from our friends at The Week magazine on Friday. And so what do you think? Is Toyota having a bad week? Is there somebody else in the news that you think could top Toyota? Probably, maybe even in your personal life. Tell us at our site, thetakeaway.org, or you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I know one person who had, well, two creatures that had
people. That's okay.
Good week. Scottish Terrier from Michigan, Sadie, is now the best in show dog from the Westminster Dog Show, and a Chihuahua named Benny. Benny got the most votes on our website, thetakeaway.org, and is now best in show from The Takeaway. He stole our listeners' hearts with his terrified expression. We're also following the stimulus bill. It's 1 year old today, but is it working for you? Give us a report. Be our reporter on the ground and tell us if you see signs of the stimulus in your neighborhood or not.
John from Beverly Hills wanted to let you know that my wife has achieved a position that she otherwise would not have achieved with the stimulus bill. She has obtained a teacher's job, and that has been significant to give us a breathing room where unemployment has otherwise hampered our family.
Give us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry this week. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.